Coming up on Tech News Weekly, Jason Howell and I talk to TechDirt's Mike Masnick about Twitter's investment in protocols over platforms. We also dig into Oculus's terms of services changes before sharing our stories of the week, YouTube's updated harassment policy, and a look back at the decade in technology. Stay tuned.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 111, recorded Thursday, December 12th, 2019.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by YouStudio. YouStudio hosts, manages, and distributes private podcasts and videocasts for businesses. Deliver corporate audio and video content securely to any device in a modern mobile-first experience. Learn more at YouStudio.com.
And by CashFly, give your users the seamless online experience that they want. Power your site or app with CashFly CDN and be 30% faster than the competition. You can learn more at twit.cashfly.com.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where we every week talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.
Oh, yeah.
I'm Micah Sargent.
And I'm Jason Howell, ready to break that news in half.
It's broken.
All right.
Cool. And first,
let's repair it for the length of the show.
Okay, so it's put back together and we talk about Twitter, the social media platform where folks, myself included, continue to ask, what in the world am I still doing here? Twitter is somewhat infamous at this point for its handling of harassment, the spread of misleading information, and an ongoing list of other complaints that wouldn't fit in our hour-long show. That said, the company does continue to seek out improvements and changes to positively impact the platform. The latest, protocols, not platforms. TechDirt's Mike Masnick is here to walk us through Jack's recent tweets. How you doing, Mike?
All right. How are you guys?
We are doing quite well. You know, I think we should kick things off kind of with the big question here. Tell me, what's the difference? Or maybe I should say, tell us, because certainly I know. Now, what's the difference between a protocol and a platform?
Yeah, I mean, the thinking here, I think, and I'm certainly not speaking for Jack or Twitter. They're doing what they're doing. But I've written about this a few times and apparently helped inspire Jack at least a little bit on this. So the thinking is sort of going back to sort of the original thinking behind the internet. The start of the internet was based on protocols. Email is SMTP. The web is HTTP. And there are a variety of other sort of just open standards that anyone could build on, and anyone could create a service built on that. You know, if you have an email system, you can email anyone else on whatever email software or server that they're using, because it's based on an open protocol and they can all communicate with each other. So the idea here in theory is that, you know, could you move social media to more of a protocol-based standard where anyone could build a different interface or could build a different, you know, filter setup or could, you know, just build different features on top of what's there, and yet allowing everyone to still control their data, decide who they want to, share their data with, but still communicate across the different kinds of implementations. Just like if you have a Gmail account and somebody else out there still has a Yahoo or AOL account that they can email across.
Yeah. So how does this differ from having apps on my device? So I might have the standard Twitter app, but I also have Tweetbot, and I don't know, there are plenty of others. I could come up with a new one.
Sure.
Twitter Bongo. Like, what's the difference between
Twitter
those?
Twitter Bongo.
I mean, there are some basic similarities there, but the difference really is that Twitter still controls everything, right? And so everything is hosted by Twitter. Everything is controlled by Twitter. If Twitter decides for good or bad reasons that it wants to cut off one of those apps, and this has happened in the past, then it can. But if it's an open protocol, then that's no longer the case. And it no longer relies on Twitter as the central arbiter of what is and what is not allowed, but is now an open protocol and people can build on it as they wish.
So obviously Jack announced this, you know, opening up this kind of research group into this. Other sites have tried this. Mastodon is just one that launched a few years ago that kind of does this. I'm trying to envision what Twitter is now compared to what it would be if this was like implemented 100%. What would you say are the big major changes based on what we know about sites like Mastodon or services like Mastodon? What would be the big change, and would that go against what Twitter is used to as far as like sustaining itself as a business?
It really depends. I mean, it depends on what they decide to do with this, you know, as they're calling a blue sky project. And that really remains to be seen. I mean, a lot of what yesterday's announcement seemed to be was sort of, you know, a plan to make a plan to explore this. And you know, who knows what that means in the long run. And that's why it's going to be really fascinating to see. But it could, you know, if it works and if it really goes down this path, it could change Twitter significantly, right? I mean, Twitter right now is you know, controls everything about Twitter, right? There are some third-party clients that work, but here the idea would be they would effectively be giving up the hosting of the data, you know, changing how it is. It would certainly impact their current advertising scheme and how they make money from that. It could impact other things. It could create different business model questions. It could create different questions about how, you know, the content moderation works on it, you know, who's in charge of different things. You could see a whole bunch of, you know, very creative, in theory, apps or interfaces on top of the, you know, Twitter corpus of data. So it could be a very, very different world.
There's a part of this that reminds me of, you know, you're a young kid, maybe playing with your siblings or playing with some friends, and you all create this game, and it doesn't matter what it is, Go-Go Bananas, and you're playing this game, and you've made up these rules, and you know, you're working on it, and somebody does something that either you don't like, or they say, you're not playing fairly, and then you go, well, fine, I'm not playing anymore. You can do it. And so you sort of give up and say, you know, that's for you to handle. Is Twitter saying, okay, we're tired of, because every time Jack sends any tweet out, you know, you can look in the replies and see all of the things that people have issues with, and then all of the other people that are kind of Twitter founders. Is this Twitter's way of saying, you know what, fine, if this is going to continue to be an issue, then we're just taking our hands off of it? I'm curious if this is more, you know, from what you've seen, you've written a lot about this, and Jack linked to your article here. Is this sort of a good faith effort, do you feel, or do you feel it's more of a, I don't really want to take responsibility for this anymore.
Right.
I'm not playing Go-Go Bananas.
Right. There's been a lot of speculation about that. And again, I cannot speak for Jack, and I don't know what's going through his mind. My sense in you know, reading through the thread and some of what has been said since then is that this is a good faith effort here, and that they are thinking seriously about this. And I get the sense that they were thinking seriously about this, you know, before they came across my paper. And, you know, some of that, it was hinted at a little bit in the thread where, you know, he more or less, you know, suggests that the real, you know, advantage that he sees that Twitter has is all the focus that they've put into whatever they're sort of referring to as conversational health. And they sort of feel that everything else may be more of a commodity aspect of their business. And so in going to a protocol-based solution, they could be moving away from all of the commodity pieces, letting anyone else do that. But they're still very much focusing on the stuff that some people claim that they're, you know, they're getting rid of or abdicating around the moderation and the, you know, conversational health aspect, as they call it. So I actually think this is, in some ways, you know, rather than you know, saying you go play, I'm not playing anymore, this is them saying we're taking this issue so seriously that we're going to open it up, and if we're not doing the best at it, then you can go somewhere else.
Do you see any potential here for other social networks to follow suit? Because this isn't just a Twitter problem. Social networks are all struggling with how they manage, you know, things like hate speech and how they draw a line, but not too firm of a line. Because, you know what I mean? Like, there's so much murkiness here. If this is Twitter's strategy and it has the potential of working, do you see other networks moving in this direction? And what keeps them all unique if they do?
It could happen. It'll be interesting. I mean, one of the things that I sort of put forth, which was purely theoretical in the paper, was that as these issues with content moderation and privacy and competition, which are all sort of big questions right now, as they get bigger and bigger, the cost effectively to the companies increases. And moving to protocols instead of, you know, controlling all of the data is a way to get that cost, you know, off the books effectively. And so I'm curious to see if they could. Twitter is in sort of a unique position. I think it would be very difficult, at least for a Facebook to sort of jump on this. And so to some extent, this is almost a little bit of a, you know, kind of jujitsu move by Twitter in that it can take this chance and experiment in this way in a way that makes it very difficult for Facebook necessarily to follow suit. But that's Facebook. That's the biggest. I think that for other, you know, sort of, you know, I don't know how to phrase it, but, you know, the companies that are not Facebook, mid-tier, whatever, I think this becomes really interesting for them in a lot of ways. And you could see other companies that have sort of social components to them, you know, beginning to think about, is this an approach that makes sense for them as well? And potentially, you know, if it all comes together, the ability to interoperate with these other platforms create some interesting and very different potential for the way the internet works and the way that we use it.
Yeah, it was Jack in one of the tweets. For instance, centralized enforcement of global policy to address abuse and misleading information is unlikely to scale over the long term without placing far too much burden on people. Mm. I originally read that as the ongoing conversation that I see Jack have, where he's saying it's not fair how much we make our users have to do content moderation and how much they have to go in and deal with the harassment that you know, they're facing. But it sounds, based on what you're saying, this is more of a conversation of placing far too much burden on people, as in within the company. The fact that they're devoting a whole team to harassment, and as Twitter grows, then that becomes a larger part of the upkeep there.
I think, and again, you know, I don't know exactly right. What he's thinking, but I think your second read on that is probably where he's at. There have been all these stories recently, mainly focused on Facebook, but you know, it's certainly true of YouTube and Twitter and Pinterest and all of these companies. You know, they've been hiring thousands and thousands of people, sometimes internally, sometimes outsourced, and sort of tasking them with going through the garbage of the internet. And you know, there have been articles about the burden that's placing on all of those people, and the idea that, you know, we need to hire so many people to sort of deal with, you know, the garbage of the internet, you know, has implications for all of those people and for the companies that are putting them in that position. And so, you know, whether or not this approach changes that, that's still very much an open question, right? I mean, there are still moderation questions, but they become very different questions when it's not, you know, a centralized platform in charge of dealing with it. And you can potentially, you know, switch that around or create competition at the level of the implementation and the filters and the moderation, and you give more control to the end users. You create a very different world in which you're not tasking a single company with hiring, you know, 10, 20,000 moderators to just look through the worst of the worst every day.
That makes sense. So yeah. I guess if this were to, you know, be put into place, I could, in theory, create my own version of Twitter or whatever this, you know, blue sky social media network ends up being called, that filters out all tweets about chocolate because for some reason I don't like chocolate. And so other people who don't like chocolate could join this instance of Twitter and also be blissfully unaware of the chocolate tweets that are on Twitter. Like, is that the idea here, that you can kind of find your own little group but still be part of the larger experience?
Yeah, that is basically the idea. And that, you know, as such, you create this sort of, you know, competitive element in terms of how the implementations work. And, you know, I liken it to email quite a bit, because I think it is actually a good example where, you know, there's all different ways to get an email address, and there are all different systems for email, and different people have different implementations. And certainly, like, you know, Google created one that is Gmail, which is very popular, but it's not the only one. And you can leave Gmail, and or you can bring in your own email address into Gmail, or you could have a Gmail account and use a different client to access your Gmail information, and you can email anyone else. And you know, Gmail has certainly become a really big one because they've added all these nice features, but there are other options out there. If you really want privacy, you go to ProtonMail or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you could see the same world. You know, and it could be as narrowly focused as you know, no chocolate allowed. You know, I don't know how successful that would be, but you know, it's out there and it's an option. And I think, you know, if this were implemented well, part of the idea is you could also then tweak that. So, you know, you could find people you could rely on. I mean, imagine, you know, the New York Times could set up their own implementation of Twitter, where they sort of put forth what they believe are kind of trusted news stories. You know, that could be interesting. You could see, you know, other people creating their own. And then, you know, you could use that implementation, but also if this is done well, it would allow you to then tweak it yourself. So maybe you don't like chocolate, so you want to opt into yours, but you also really like smoothies. So you want to pull in all this extra information on smoothies, and you could sort of, you know, very easily, you know, again, depending on how it's done, bring that into your world, and everyone could effectively customize it if they want. You know, one of the complaints that I saw a bunch of people saying was, oh, the end users don't want to have to fit with this stuff. And that's true. And I think that most end users won't, but having the option there, if they do, I think becomes really powerful. And I think also what it does is it encourages people to come up with implementations that create, you know, a better user experience for people, and also puts in place incentives that whoever is creating those implementations don't abuse it. You know, in the same way that if Gmail were suddenly, you know, doing something that was privacy abusive, everyone would switch off of Gmail to other email accounts. So they wouldn't lose their contacts with anyone else. They wouldn't lose their ability to email anyone else. They wouldn't even lose their historical emails because you can pull all those out of Gmail. And so that helps keep Gmail from you know, acting evilly in how they run that platform. And I think you would get that same kind of thing with social media if the ability to move or switch or leave whichever implementation you're relying on is, you know, is effectively the click of a button.
Excellent. Well, listeners out there, please don't use SMTP to email me about chocolate. I do love chocolate, and it was just for the sake of the conversation. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike Masnick. If folks want to follow you online, how can they do so?
I'm at M. Masnick on Twitter, which is, you know, still the centralized setup for today. Who knows where I'll be in the future if Blue Sky ever becomes a thing. But right now, just M. Masnick, M-M-A-S-N-I-C-K, or I write at techdirt.com all the time.
Awesome. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Coming up, if you thought an escape to a virtual reality world meant an escape from tracking and data privacy concerns... you'd be wrong.
Yeah.
But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by U Studio. Now, it's safe to say you like staying informed through shows just like ours. And, well, you're not alone. 44% of Americans turn to podcasts for their news and information. So it's no wonder that businesses want to leverage this medium for their workforces. So imagine this. Your company had its own podcast to keep folks updated on the latest company-related news. How convenient would that be? Probably super convenient. And that's why you need to check out U Studio. U Studio hosts, manages, and distributes private podcasts and videocasts for businesses. It's fully customizable with your company's logo and colors and lets your organization deliver confidential information securely to your employees, remote workforces, customers, and partners. Studies show that audio and video formats are up to 700% more effective than text, since email updates are so easy to miss or ignore. Think of all the ways your company could utilize a private podcast or videocast with U Studio. You can provide detailed analytics. You can know who's engaging with what, when, and how often. You can ensure your confidential business information is never discoverable online. You can quickly authenticate users using SSO or other authentication protocols. You can implement in hours instead of months. Restrict access by department, by seniority, by location. and they can be downloaded and listened to on demand so your users can make the most of the time that usually gets lost during commuting or traveling. That's so nice, the idea of being able to listen to the podcast on the way, and you're getting information about the company, you know what the latest and greatest thing is, and maybe, whoa, maybe that cuts back on meetings. Everybody would love to go to less meetings. I know I would. Ah, so great to have just a little podcast to listen to while you're on the subway on your way to work. Less meetings sounds great. So join companies like Salesforce, Nike, Dell, who trust UStudio to power their private podcasts. You go to ustudio.com today to request your free trial or a personalized demo. And of course, be sure to mention you heard about it from us, Tech News Weekly. That's the letter U, studio.com. Thanks so much, UStudio.
Thank you, UStudio. All right. The day Oculus was acquired by Facebook back in 2014, many ardent VR fans began to worry a little bit when your favorite hardware suddenly belongs to arguably one of the biggest names in technology. There's really no telling what that actually is going to end up meaning for the brand, for the product. A lot of people saw the sky is falling, but they've waited it out. And times right now are changing. Ian Hamilton from Upload VR is here to talk about some of those changes. Welcome to the show for the first time, Ian. It's great to have you
on.
Thank you. We appreciate your time. So first of all, talk a little bit about the changes to the terms of service that were announced. I believe this was just yesterday.
Yeah. So the biggest change here is that they're going to start watching what apps you use when you use an Oculus VR headset, assuming that you've connected your Facebook account, and maybe serve you some ads elsewhere on the internet to, in theory, be relevant to you. So based on your activity in VR, maybe they can suggest another app that you might enjoy because you've spent time in a similar app.
Okay. I mean, is this very different from kind of the other ways that we're tracked? It's just kind of now our activity within the VR space is noted. Like, it's, you know, it's going to be similar, like related to my experience. Ads appearing in the usual places, or is this ads within the VR experience? Because I can imagine, like, I feel like that's on the cusp. I feel like at some point we're going to start seeing this intrusion into the virtual world of the ad experience in the way that we witness it on the web. And this isn't that, right?
Well, I think the trick there is that Facebook seems very focused on trying to make a developer community that makes money from selling games, not offering free games. And as long as developers can make money by just selling their software directly to users for $30, $40 per game, hopefully that keeps the ads at bay for a little while. I mean, I remember my first iPhone apps had very few or no ads in them. And over time, that market got eaten out and all the free apps started taking over. And then the ads started finding their way into my phone. So right now, Facebook is very focused on trying to build that community of developers who make money directly from the sale of their games. And I think that would be the biggest thing that would impact whether we'll see ads in virtual space. But absolutely right. I mean, it's sort of inevitable as these products become more robust to start seeing other ways these companies are going to try to make money.
Yeah. And you have to know that at some point changes are going to happen, right? It's been 5 years. Facebook has owned Oculus. Oculus Quest, big success. It's making a lot of money and a lot of attention for the VR space. So there's a lot to be gained from this. Did Facebook ever say along the way that they would not do something like this? Because, you know, sometimes these acquisitions happen and in the very beginning they're like,
don't worry.
Like, don't worry. We're not changing a single thing.
Everything will
be
the same
thing. You're all good.
Yeah.
But then now, over time, I mean, you know, 5 years is a long time. Business interests shift and move. And like, I can kind of understand that. But what's your take?
Well, so there's been a clear consolidation there where Instagram, WhatsApp, and then Oculus are three of the biggest acquisitions I can point to from Facebook over the last few years. And this year, Facebook really made it clear and known that we need to change our strategy and consolidate these teams and really focus them around their main products. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I stopped using Facebook to share lots of personal details a long time ago. So I became uncomfortable with sharing lots of videos, photos, and text on there. And I imagine that's the experience of a lot of people, given the ongoing criticism that they experience from so many different places. And so what I noticed in this last year was Facebook sort of focusing on Messenger and more private forms of communication and trying to facilitate those. And a lot of it is about consolidating around those more private forms of communication. And that's part of the announcements this week, is they're pushing many of their social features into the Oculus ecosystem so that you can, say, message people from VR and get them on their mobile phone and maybe invite them into your virtual experience with you.
Right. And one component of this is Facebook Horizon, which is kind of like the Facebook in VR experience, which you can't access if you don't have a Facebook account, right? Like I also, I don't know if you don't have a Facebook account or if you're just not using it to share things. I got rid of my Facebook account probably about, I think at this point, about a year and a half ago, you know, kind of hit the same point that you're talking about, where it's like, you know, I just don't feel comfortable with this. So I pulled out entirely and haven't looked back. But then I'm also a really big fan of the Oculus Quest, and so I find myself very conflicted, because I'm like, on one hand, I love this technology, and I appreciate the work that's been done here and the experience. But on the other hand, it becomes hard for me to buy into that when I know that kind of the Facebook ecosystem is behind it, and I'm just I just don't feel willing to like sign up for a Facebook account. What does that mean for me as a user of the Quest going forward?
Yeah, so I'm kind of in between there. I went with both. So I deleted my Facebook account and then started a new one to give myself a fresh start. And I honestly think that would be my recommendation for lots of people that feel uncomfortable to sort of give yourself a clear history there with Facebook, hopefully. I mean, I don't know what's keeping them from dredging up your what you think is a deleted Facebook account and right. Using that to target info. But totally. That was sort of my strategy. Delete the old Facebook account, that I can't remember the updates that I left there a decade ago, and give myself a fresh start and then connect that to my Oculus account. And what you lose is these first party social features. So this thing where you're partying up with friends or trying to go from app to app together and experience things with different people or bringing people outside of VR into VR with you is going to be harder to do. You can still use apps like Rec Room, VR Chat with the account systems and the party systems they have installed on their third party apps. But it's going to be harder for you to connect with friends if you don't do that Facebook link.
Yeah, right. Like on other platforms would be, you know, PlayStation Plus would be, you know, kind of this multiplayer experience. It seems like emerging on the Oculus platform is that Facebook is that social kind of layer, that social connection. And if you're not cool with Facebook, then you're missing out on a lot of really big features, which is kind of a bummer.
The interesting comments I'm seeing from people are people suggesting that they're going to set up fake Facebook accounts specifically to do this connection. And that's right. That kind of goes against specifically what Facebook is arguing that their purpose for this feature is. Because some of these features were there prior to needing this Facebook connection. And they kind of are retiring some of those old features and replacing them with the required Facebook connection. And it's that they require on the Facebook terms of service, the main Facebook terms of service, that the name you use on Facebook be the name you use in everyday life.
Right.
And it's almost like they're encouraging some people that really don't want to listen to fake it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Driving them in a direction that I know Facebook doesn't want people to go. They've been discouraging that for years. You know, that's been a really big key point that they've been trying to discourage. But anyone who has this headset, I mean, you can willfully go in there, even if you do have a Facebook account, you just don't want to connect it, and you can deny that connection. The point is, somewhere along the line, you're going to see kind of features that aren't available to you, or things that maybe are broken, but gracefully broken. I don't know.
Hopefully, that's ideally, yeah.
Yeah. You also mentioned in your article that there's a lot of goodwill with the Oculus right now. There have been some big announcements this, you know, the past couple of weeks. Do you get the feeling that like this announcement, Oculus and Facebook, had a feeling might kind of ruffle some feathers. So there's some sort of timing with like, hey, here's a bunch of really great features that make us awesome. And oh, by the way, this thing. whisper.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine them doing the reverse. So like over the last few weeks, they added hand tracking and they told people to expect hand tracking. So that's, I've got the controllers here, and typically to track your hands and the movements of the hands, you use the controllers, but the hand tracking just, they use the cameras on the headset to see where your hands are. And it's a very, very good way to introduce people to the first, to VR for the first time, because lots of these headsets over the last 5 years, they didn't have cameras on them, and people would still put their hands up in front of their headsets looking for their hands, and they wouldn't see them. So hand tracking is like it's a very good way to onboard someone to virtual reality for the first time. And they rolled that out. They said they were going to roll that out early in 2020, and then sort of Christmas surprise, holiday season surprise, it's actually rolling out now. And so all these people are going to be trying the Oculus Quest for the first time over the holiday season here, and getting to experience that sort of awe of having your hands in VR for the first time without having any controllers. And then the other big thing they did was Oculus Link, which allows you to hook up your standalone headset, which works great wirelessly, great on its own, to a PC to access some incredible games that are only on PC right now. So things like Boneworks, things like No Man's Sky, Skyrim VR, all can be brought over this wired connection to your Quest, and provides an incredible experience that many people didn't know they were going to get when they first bought this headset in the earlier part of the year. So they announced both of those things over the last month, and then right after that said, oh, by the way, we're gonna start using your data for ads.
Well, big changes. Again, like I go back and forth. Like I'm totally torn on the Quest, because I love the hardware. I think as far as VR, accessible but high quality VR is concerned, like it's the perfect balance. So I love that about it. But then I'm totally conflicted because of the Facebook behind it that I've really in most other facets of my life stepped away from. Yep. So I will continue to struggle. That's my struggle, not yours.
it's interesting watching the comments. I mean, those early adopters there were there with you, but the people now just see it as ad targeting, and they see it as, they've been through, they knew what they were buying when they bought the headset. They knew they were buying something from Facebook, and I think a lot of them knew to expect this kind of change.
Yeah, it was kind of inevitable. Ian Hamilton with Upload VR. Ian, thank you for taking time out to join us. You also have a podcast. What's the name of the podcast? And tell people
the VR download. Where just say okay, play the VR download or haste.
Yeah, right on. VR download. Thank you, Ian. We'll talk to you soon. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right. Now up next, Micah and I have a few stories of the week that we'll dive into. So that's coming up. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CashFly, so you can give your users the seamless online experience that they want. Power your site or your app with CashFly CDN and be 30% faster than the competition. No matter what industry your business is in, if your website is directly tied to company revenue, you can give your customers the fast downloads that they need with CashFly. CashFly CDN delivers rich media content up to 10 times faster than traditional delivery methods and up to 30% faster than other major CDNs. It's backed by a 100% SLA. CashFly guarantees the best user experience for all your customers, no matter where they are, no matter what device they happen to be on. You can join the thousands of others who trust CashFly's reliable network, including LG, Microsoft, Adobe, and Ars Technica, and of course, Twit. We've been hosting our podcasts, all of our audio, our video content on CashFly for a decade. Every month, you, our viewers, our listeners, download petabytes of data, and it's fast, it's flawless, and we would not be here. We would not exist in the same way that we do without CashFly and the support on the back end. So say goodbye to logging in multiple times a week, or worse, even daily, trying to track your CDN usage. There's no billing spikes. You'll get a custom plan tailored to your CDN needs based on yearly usage trends. On average, customers who switch to CashFly save more than 20%. You can imagine what you could do with that 20% in your time. And just for Twit listeners, CashFly is giving away a complimentary detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and usage trends so you can see if you're overpaying 20% or more for CDN. Learn more at twit.cashfly.com. That's twit.cashfly.com. And we thank CashFly for their support and for their support over the last decade. That's a long time. We're going to talk about this decade in a moment. But first, we've got your story coming up.
Nice. So Wednesday, which was yesterday in our current timeline.
Yes.
I can't speak for those other timelines.
Right.
Who knows?
It's messy.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. YouTube put out a blog post talking about an update to their harassment policy. The company has faced a lot of scrutiny, I think particularly in this last year, like many online platforms,
yeah.
It seems,
yeah.
For not handling harassment very well. There was, I think it was Carlos Maza,
mm-hmm.
Who was harassed over the course of time, targeted harassment, and faced some very nasty things happening to him, including being doxxed and horrible things said about him, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on. And that was kind of one of the more publicized versions. But YouTube has historically not done a very good job with this in general. And we recently, I think we talked to somebody actually about YouTube's changes where it said, hey, if your content is not monetarily valuable to us, then we
right.
reserve the right to sort of get rid of it. And there was some discussion about how that could be a way for them to use that clause to get rid of bad actors on the platform, but it's not as forthright. And so this
never is.
Yeah. In fact, there's some criticism about this, but YouTube has updated its harassment policy. And one of the things that they say, we will no longer allow content that maliciously insults someone based on protected attributes such as their race, gender expression, or sexual orientation. This applies to everyone from private individuals to YouTube creators to public officials.
Good. That's solid.
It sounds good. Yeah. And this, they call this a stronger stance against threats and personal attacks, as well as consequences for a pattern of harassing behavior. So if creators on YouTube that are being monetized, so that are making money from the platform, continue to, as they put it, I think they say brush up against YouTube's harassment policy, they will be removed from the YouTube Partner Program and therefore will no longer make money on the content. So that sort of incentive to continue to create content
okay.
will go away. And then there, that incentive is not there as much. And in theory, that makes them not want to continue to do it. That's the part where it's kind of like,
right.
Does it do anything?
They'll continue to do it.
Yeah. You know, and then, of course, addressing toxic comments, which... If there's one platform where you never read the comments and you've never read the comments or you have always been told to never read the comments, it's YouTube, which
yeah.
tells me that they didn't get this right from the beginning. They continue to not get it right. But apparently they are working on that as well. There were more than 16 million comments removed in the third quarter of this year alone, which is that 16 or? Yeah, yeah,
16 million in the third quarter alone.
Which there are 16 million comments that are violating YouTube's policies.
Yeah.
I hope that there aren't 16 million or even half of that. There aren't 8 million people out there that are leaving horrible, mean comments on people's posts. And that some of those are just sort of spam bots and ad bots. Because that just kind of breaks my heart that there's that much mean stuff being put out into the world.
That's a huge number.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Oh, but I'm sorry. It says right here, specifically due to harassment. Those 16 million that were yeah. removed, those were specifically due to harassment. That's a bummer. That's a big bummer to me.
Yeah, that's insanity, that number. And just the problem, I mean, obviously it's not easy.
No.
YouTube's been struggling with this for years. And it's all about numbers. The amount of people that are hitting these sites, YouTube sites specifically, the fact that you can basically say anything, have it be seen by anyone, and based on those sheer numbers, it's so easy to hide in plain sight. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And to everyone else, mm-hmm. to the creator, it's so obvious.
Yes.
But to everyone else, it's hiding in plain sight because there's so many of mm-hmm. these bad comments everywhere yeah. that it's like, where do you even start to draw the line? I'm curious to know how, I applaud YouTube for continuing to kind of write this language into how, you know, their terms of service and to correct the platform. I feel like it's long overdue, you know. Like toxic YouTube comments, as just one example, mm-hmm. has been there for so long.
Yes.
And, you know, and it, so it's not like it's a recent problem, let alone, you know, harassment in videos and everything. I mean, it's, the problem is just so huge because the numbers are so large. And so I can't help but be skeptical. You know what I mean? Like, I love that YouTube is doing this, and mm-hmm. I think it's important and necessary. But it just continues to, I continue to find myself skeptical about it because it doesn't seem like anything ever works, even though changes have been made.
Yeah.
But I'm hopeful.
Well, and I think with that, I think anyone who works at the company who's not foolish would respect the fact that you are skeptical. You know what I mean? Because yeah. we've seen time and time again getting hopeful about the changes actually happening, then we get sort of slapped in the face and it doesn't end up working.
Right.
And so one would hope that they would understand your skepticism and that they are working to prove you wrong.
Yeah, one would
or
hope.
Or increase your hope that it will actually change. Because, yeah, right now, it is a toxic garbage fire in the comments. And like you said, we've had this, I can remember, I don't know, as long as I've ever looked at videos on YouTube,
yeah,
someone was saying somewhere, never read the comments, never read the comments. That's not changed.
Right. And it's really easy to just leave whatever happens to be on your mind in that moment. I think that's part of it is people have very knee-jerk reactions to something that they're watching or to a comment or whatever. And it's very easy in that moment of like passionate rage or whatever just drop whatever and forget about it. It's like you drop it and you move on.
Not only do you forget about it, it's a sort of like context switching, but there's a psychological concept that you and I are susceptible to as people who appear on a screen in front of someone. Yeah. We have a natural predisposition psychologically to remove the humanity of a person who is not humanly in front of us. Mm. And so when you're watching YouTube yeah. videos, you're not thinking of that person. Well, I shouldn't say you're not, because some people do remember that they're sure. a person, but your natural inclination is not to think of that person as a person. It is more of a sort of construct. And so it's easier to be hurtful to someone totally. Who's not right in front of you. So I'm not surprised. I'm just saddened by the fact that there were 16 million comments removed in the third quarter alone, specifically yeah. due to harassment. At the same time, I'm glad that YouTube is continuing to look at this, and more importantly, that the shouting that is taking place, that the folks that are trying to keep YouTube on their best game are actually being heard in some way,
yeah.
and that they're, you know, working to make a change. So
totally.
Change can take place. I just think there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I mean, Carlos Maza is like prime example of that. When he first started kind of petitioning around this and kind of making the news around, you know, the degrading stuff that was being said about him in these videos, there really wasn't a whole lot of action that
yeah,
happened.
It was bad,
you know, and it's taken this long. I think that was earlier this year sometime, probably like summer, if not before. I can't remember exactly when it was this year, but plenty of time has passed mm-hmm. and now we're here. And even Carlos says he's skeptical. He's extremely skeptical that this is going to change anything. So it's kind of like prove it, and we'll see what that means. What does the platform look like if and when these changes are made? Another thing that kind of gives me some pause is that YouTube, and actually all platforms in general on this sort of stuff, are really good at finding exceptions to the rule. Like yeah. they're really good at being like, oh yeah, I know we said that. You know what? In this case, it kind of doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't match. And here's the reasons why. And it's
right.
like, I don't care what your reasons are. Like you said, you wouldn't do it. And yet here we are again, because it's, you know, and they do specify public officials. So great. That's awesome, because I think other platforms aren't willing to go there.
Right.
But I have to imagine there's going to be some shades of gray with this.
Oh, of course.
You know, that's just the way it goes.
Probably more than 50.
Yeah, probably 51 at
51 least. 51 shades of gray.
Yeah. So anyways, we'll definitely cross our fingers and hope this turns it's into a better YouTube.
All we can do.
All we can do, dang it. It's the end of the year. Nay, the end of the decade.
What?
This only happens once every 10 years. Did you know that? A decade only happens once. A new decade?
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Ten.
Yeah.
So, got it.
See, I'm smart. As such, expect an avalanche of best of the decade articles and videos in all categories.
Oof.
The first that I've actually kind of thumbed through and scrolled through is The Verge's recent Gadgets of the Decade list, where they detail the 100 gadgets that they think defined the 2010s. And I didn't pull anything out specifically. I just had a lot of fun kind of thumbing through here and going, oh, yeah, I remember that. And then adding up all the things that I've had over the years or still have. I mean, right at the top of the list or at the end of the list, actually, numerically. But the first item there, number 100, is Google Glass. And yes, unfortunately, I've had that. In fact, I have that. It's in the other room. So... So yeah. If you ever want to borrow my Google Glass, just let me know. I'd be curious to see what it looks like on you.
It looks just as foolish as it does on everyone else.
But yeah, it's kind of fun to thumb through here and be
fidget spinner.
Yeah. So yeah, I thought that was an interesting inclusion.
It's not quite a gadget, is it?
I mean, I guess it's a gadget. It's not quite tech.
It's a gizmo.
Yeah, it's a gizmo. Okay, that works. But you know, people are flipping out about fidget spinners, thinking it was going to take over the world, and then it kind of fizzled out, as things do.
Uh-huh.
As bad as anything ever seems, you know, eventually they disappear. Wow, you're going through that list super fast.
The backup camera. That actually, because the highway, the national highway, blah, 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 blah.
Uh-huh.
You have to have that highway. You know them. Yeah. You have to have backup cameras.
Seriously?
Well, yes. Well, sorry. Cars manufactured after a certain date have to have backup cameras in them now. It's a law that they do.
Yeah.
Yes, the Pebble was just on screen,
yeah.
The Pebble smartwatch, which, yeah. Of course, made a change. And then, of course, the Philips Hue system.
Yes,
to this day.
Like, as I was going through this list, and I didn't have enough time to do it, but as I was going through, I was like, yep, I've got that, I've got that, I've got that. Oh, no, I've got that. I was like, whoa, if I could just pull myself together and bring all of these things in here, but I couldn't quite.
Do you have a boosted board?
I don't.
Oh.
No. Do you?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
I also don't have a Boston Dynamics Spot robot.
Well, I do have that.
As much as I would love to have one.
I'm not allowed to bring it to work. Anywhere where there are cameras, I can't bring it. So it has to stay at home.
That's true.
In one specific room where I have no security cameras.
And just a robot running in circles.
Yeah, but I mean, that's all, you know, it gets its work out during the day. And then I come home and I say hi to it.
I think it might hate you after a while for keeping it in a room.
Is that what all that scratching is at night?
Yes, exactly. Webcam cover is in here. Let's see.
Wait, webcam cover, like as in, wait, this is the best one. Number 26, the frayed lightning cable.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many friends I had to guilt and shame. I had to guilt and shame for their nonsense of, I mean, it was practically they chewed up a piece of Hubba Bubba bubble gum and stuck the thing back together. And I'm like, can you please just get a new one? I remember one person was like, yeah, sometimes I'll grab it the wrong way and it shocks me. Why are you still using this cable?
Yeah, that's an indication of something.
Yeah.
Be receptive. Be aware of what that actually means.
Yeah.
And
take a second. You know, maybe think about it.
Take a step in the right direction.
Oh, my word. Number 12, too. The TV remote with the Netflix button. Every time I see a remote that has a logo button on it makes me so sad.
It does. It makes me sad, too. Even though I'm a Netflix user,
yes.
I still never press that dang button if it's on a remote.
I do the navigation to get there instead of pressing that button because I am morally opposed to logo buttons because those things change and go away.
Yep. Totally agree.
Voodoo who?
And we can just go ahead and let everyone know what the number one is because it's you got to check out the list. It's not like we're spoiling the surprise. The Apple iPhone 4. This is the 2010 iPhone 4, which the Verge staff says is like the marquee kind of like example for the industry of what smartphone has become.
Okay.
Over the year, you know, it was the first model that had the front facing camera and it was kind of like the quintessential glass sandwich device. But it was also the phone that if you gripped it too hard, the antenna
if you held it
reception,
just right, yeah, which was
or just wrong.
Then the antenna gate.
So there's that. Antenna, I remember at the time AntennaGate was, you know, all the articles were like, AntennaGate is going to ruin Apple. And that did not happen.
Oh, and that was also the one with phone left in a bar.
Phone left in a bar. That was the one.
A phone walks into a bar.
So many wonderful stories came from the iPhone 4.
Oh, my goodness.
Did you have the iPhone 4?
I did have an iPhone 4 in white. So, okay. Wait, maybe that was the 4S. I can't remember if the 4 came in white. But I had that form factor.
Okay.
And I did get a free bumper.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So that I was no longer holding it wrong. It is a pretty phone to this day. I think it's a pretty phone. iOS is a little dated on it, but if I could get a new version of iOS running on that style of phone, I might carry that around.
Yeah. I mean, The Verge says the iPhone 4 is the most beautiful smartphone ever made.
I don't know if I agree with that.
I'm not sure.
I like that Lumia Windows phone.
What was that?
I think it's on the list, but I don't
know. Nokia Lumia 1020. It's number 92.
I think that phone's so pretty.
Yeah, I remember those. Oh, do you remember Windows Phone?
Yeah. Rest in peace.
R.I.P.
Pour one out for Windows Phone. Just kidding.
No, don't pour it right there. There's lines on the floor that indicate where the table goes. Anyways, there's a lot of cool stuff in here, so check it out if you have 10 minutes and you want to go, oh, yeah, I remember that. Oh, I have that. Oh, I'm sorry I have that.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry I spent money on that.
Yeah, Coolest Cooler, you remember that one?
I remember. That was a controversy three quarters.
For Kickstarter and crowdfunding.
Oh, my word.
So,
wow. Anyways,
good
back
job, The Verge.
In my day, we had coolers that cooled themselves. These days, you just spray it with a ray gun and everything's nice and chilly.
Oh, just think of all the innovation coming to coolers over the next 10 years. What cooler tech will we be talking about 10 years from now on Tech News Weekly, Micah?
I don't know, but it'll be cool.
Ah, that's true. That was pretty cool. I like what you did there.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. We are done.
Are we?
That is it. We've reached the bottom. Tech News Weekly publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. That's where you can go to subscribe to this show, because I know now you really want to subscribe to this show if you haven't already, in audio and video formats.
You can be part of the show if you email us at tnw@twit.tv and follow us on social media. That's @twit on Twitter, @twit.tv on Instagram, and @twittalk, TWITTOK, on TikTok.
Oh my goodness, so many T's. The alliteration is
all the T's. Spill the tea. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm @MicahSargent.
Once I like clue into the sound of the T, it's all I hear. I'm @JasonHowell on Twitter. Thanks to our TD, that is John Ashley. Also thanks to Jeff, John, and Burke, and everyone who helped us do the show each and every week. And thanks to you for watching Tech News Weekly. We'll see you
next time.
There we go. All right.
Ta-ta for now.